Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show. And today's guest is Tracy Austin. Tracy, thank you for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Peter. Thank you for inviting me.
No, you're more than welcome. You're more than welcome. Now, just quickly before I go any further, I just want people and the guests to know that my other Skype account's been hacked. Somebody's going around trying to get people to give them iTunes cards, something like that. Hundreds of people have been affected because I can't contact everyone because of the large amount of contacts I had on there. But just be aware, people, I have put out messages. I'm sorry if they've got to you or they're weird people typing to you, but it's not me. I've just had to do that as a format quickly because there's no other way I can get out to everyone. But Tracy, we'll go into your story, your experiences. You've done a lot. You've written a few books. How did all this sort of start for you?
Oh my gosh, how much time do you have, Peter?
It's like that, isn't it? I might have to get you back on for a handful of shows, which would be cool.
Well, to be quite honest with you, I had no intentions of ever being involved with anything like this. This completely threw me for a loop because I think probably people who know me by now know that I started out as a musician. I actually trained as a classical concert pianist in London. And I went to the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, and I used to practice, you know, 7-8 hours a day. So it was a pretty intense daily regime that I used to have. And so none of this was on my mind at all. And one clear blue sky day, I happened to be talking with my best friend who was a guitarist. He was also a musician. And at the YMCA where we were staying as students, we were having a conversation and something caught my attention outside the window in the sky. And what it was a cone-shaped object. It was pointed at the top and rounded at the bottom. So it looked a little bit like what we call in England, like a dunce's hat, mm-hmm. Right? Pointed at the top, or a witch's hat even. Pointed at the top, rounded at the bottom, and it was rotating as it was going through the sky. And this thing catches my eye, and I said to my best friend, as you do, what the bloody hell is that? You know? So he looked and he said, it's a UFO. I said, what do you mean? What do you mean a UFO? So he explained to me. And I said, okay, so you mean this thing has come from either another planetary system or it's interdimensional? And he said, yes, because he'd seen things as a kid, whereas I hadn't, or so I had thought. Mm-hmm. So I continue to watch this thing. We both stand and watch it, and it's rotating as it's going through the sky. And I know it's made of metallic because I can see the way the sun is hitting it, and it's glinting.
Yep.
So I know it's metallic. And it's just moving around at a clockwise motion through the sky and out of view. And so I was so excited about this, I could not stop telling everybody that evening what we'd seen. And it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon when we'd seen this thing. And so the very next day, we go to, I forget where we were going, but we were going on an underground tube, train station somewhere. And when we get out the other end, my friend says to me, oh my gosh, look, there's the guy selling newspapers at the entrance, and he says, oh my gosh, look, we're on there's the UFO on the front of the newspaper. The headline, UFOs.
So,
yeah, UFOs see.
Yeah.
Very important. So yeah. We thought we were the only people, but we weren't. So it made the front page headline news of the Evening Standard newspaper.
That's
so
good.
From then on, I was hooked. I had to find out, what are these things? Who is piloting these things? Why are they here? What do they want? So since 1987, I've pretty much been on that whole journey.
Where do things go from there? Like, because you aren't over there anymore in England. Obviously, things have continued because it's, and I've spoken to a hell of a lot of researchers where it seems that if you seem to put this in the background, things die off. But if you seem to have intention, you get, I guess, obsessed. And I would have to say that a large majority of us do get obsessed with this because you want to know what's going on. You're experiencing things and it's fascinating. It seems to attract the phenomena no matter what it is, whether it's something side by side with us, whatever the aspect of it is, it seems to attract this reality. So how did things progress for you from there? Because obviously you've gone to America and things have continued.
Yes, absolutely. From there, Peter, what I did, I attended UFO conferences in England and also out here in the United States. Typically the Laughlin UFO Congress, mm-hmm. that used to be in Laughlin, that's now moved to Arizona, of course, and bought as many books and videos and DVDs as I could find on the subject, and clearly followed it mm-hmm. all the way through. So it's never stopped. It's as if it said to me, you're not going to go down this road that you think you're going to go down as a musician. You're going to go down this one, and you're going to find out what we're about and who we are. So it clearly has taken over that side of my life. Hence I'm no longer a musician. I don't perform anymore, and I don't pursue that side of my life. This has come full blown on, and there's no way I can ignore it or deny it through what I've seen.
That's funny, because I spoke to people like Grant Cameron and others where they covered the rock star phenomena, where, you know, famous people have had experiences in the amount, whether it's Elvis, Muhammad Ali, lots of people from all walks of life that are in different parts of the entertainment industry have had experiences. I myself, I've done around 14, 15 albums, and that all went to the back burner from my experiences as well. Though I am working on something now that's about to come out. I thought I'd never do it again, but it's probably the best work I've done. And I think it's because of where my intention and my heart lies with it. But with that said, it's funny the amount of people that are musicians, artists, I guess it might have something to do with the part of the brain that we use, where we may be more opened to things like this. So do you think that might be an aspect of it? Because it's changed your whole life, yet you've got that you're more using the right part of your brain than the left doing the musical thing.
Right. And I agree with you, Peter, because with musicians, we have a sensitivity about us to create music and to, you know, develop the music, create it and put it out there. So it requires a certain amount of sensitivity and a fine tuning, I think, which obviously seems to coincide with seeing these things. Although I know there are people, many people out there who are not musicians and that have seen these things, because this is for all walks of life. Yeah. Everyone from all walks of life is seeing it, whether it's the man on the street, the doctor, the politician, the person who works at the dry cleaners, the local bank. You know, we're all seeing these things. But I think, yes, with musicians, there's a certain sensitivity that seems to just home in with this subject.
Now, you've done a lot of media stuff as well. How did that come into the picture later on for you? Obviously, like, that was in the paper in England, that sighting. You had nothing to do with that, though you did see the object. How did that sort of, when you got to America, things open up? Did they just sort of just happen? Obviously, you had another sighting after that, you know, got coverage as well. Do you want to go into that?
Absolutely. Well, at that time in London, obviously we had that sighting and I continued on the path of exploring. Mm-hmm. I then moved from London back to my hometown for a while, which I still had sightings, one of which was a boomerang shaped object. And I also organized a couple of UFO conferences in England as well in both 96 and 98. Then I came out to America. And I lived in California. And by this time, obviously the subject meant a great deal to me and it was very, very serious for me. And I wanted to create a TV show for it. So I went to our cable station and said, I want to put on a show for the general public about the paranormal, which would encompass UFOs, ghosts, hauntings, you name it, astrology, numerology, Bigfoot, no matter what it was going to encompass A to Z of the strange but true. And so we started that show in 2002, mm-hmm. and it was a really successful show. And we co-produced it in New York as well, so the show got to be seen in New York, and also in some 486,000 homes in Arizona, and also a very small town in Iowa, where I had a co-producer that wanted to air the shows because he really liked what we were doing. And then we won 3 awards for the show for its excellence, 3 Telly Awards. So we have the website that's dedicated to the show, so you can see clips of the show on there. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to work on a couple of different projects right now to get the show back on the air.
Yep.
In some way.
I hope all the best with that as well. That would be fantastic.
Thank you.
That would be awesome. Now, you've done a few books as well. We'll go into that because something that I myself have experienced, and I think everyone who's experiencing this stuff, they do it, whether it's ghost stuff, they eventually get into the UFO stuff or vice versa. Other things, whether it's esoteric stuff or, you know, Bigfoot, elemental stuff, nature spirits, Egypt, Lemuria, all this stuff. You've done a book called Welcome to Haunted Las Vegas. How did that come about?
Well, welcome to Haunted Las Vegas, Nevada. That little book came about in 2009. And I had been approached by Schiffer Publishing, who published the book, to ask if I wanted to write something about hauntings in Las Vegas. And I had no desire really to write about hauntings in Las Vegas, really. You know, the path had been UFOs and ETs and that kind of thing. But I was up for a challenge and I thought, why not? So I managed to contact a investigations team out here, a paranormal investigations team, called the Las Vegas Society of Supernatural Investigations. And they're a team of 4 credible people who go around in Las Vegas to residential hauntings and clear those homes of ghost activity. And they're really great at what they do. They're very genuine and they're very great at what they do. So I had sat with them and took 18 of what I felt were the best accounts of their investigations and put them into Welcome to Haunted Las Vegas, Nevada. And there's 18 true chapters, true accounts in there of these investigations that LVSSI did. And it was great working with them, and the book had been successful. And it goes to prove that out here in the Silver State, there are hauntings. And people are under the misconception that for some reason, you have to be in an old home to have hauntings. Well, in actual fact, you don't. It can be in new homes. And this is what it goes into in the book in many different circumstances. But like I said, they were very successful in getting rid of the ghost activity.
Did it open you up a bit to different things that you hadn't thought about with this whole area of the paranormal in terms of, you know, there's some ghost cases, because I've done that as well. I actually go and help people clear their homes, and I've done investigations and that. And when doing it, there's so much I've learned from it. Even just stories that can blow your mind. Like, there's one story I came across from another ghost hunting crew there in America, and the house was haunted. And they got some video, and when they showed the person who owned the home the video, it was her as a kid. It was a residual haunting. And she, as a kid, that energy was trapped there, recycled, going over and over.
Wow.
You know what I mean? So this is stuff where I'm like, wow. Or there'll be 2 people in a 3-story building, a floor apart, and they'll both get touched in the same area at the same time. You know, just little things like this, which go out of linear time. These are things where, you know, I love this sort of stuff because I learned so much about my reality and what I've experienced. Have you come across similar weird things like that?
Well, I have, Peter. Well, not quite like that, but I can say, I mean, I've had a personal ghost sighting myself that was headless. And again, for me, it all happened in London.
Yeah.
For some reason, you know.
That seems to be a major hotspot too for all that.
Yes, very much so. And again, I'm with my best friend when we see this. But yeah, I didn't realize how haunted Las Vegas really is. And to know, for example, that ghost activity They tend to, with ghost activity, the ghosts tend to, not all the time, but a lot of the time, try and contact you by telephone. Mm-hmm. And they try and reach you that way. Now, I thought maybe I was the only person that it happened to, because when I got married, I'm now divorced, but when I got married in 2001, my ex-husband and I had that very experience of the phone ringing about three times in the same evening, with a 30-minute gap between each call, and all there was on the end of the line was static. And at one point, we were actually at a UFO conference in Orange County in California when this happened, and then we went back to Vegas, and we stayed at the Mandalay Bay Hotel, and the phone starts to ring in the hotel room, and yet the phone is not plugged into the socket. At the time, my husband's computer was plugged in, but the phone was still ringing. And it's like, how does that happen? Now, my dear psychic friend in England, when I told her about this, said to me, because I had no idea, she said to me, it was your grandmother and your grandfather trying to get through to you to wish you all the luck in the world on your wedding day. I said, wow. I had no idea. But I never heard anything on the phone. Mm-hmm. It was just static the whole time.
Well, it's like you see with those ghost box, they use like the white noise and the beings trying to manipulate it to make words or something from it. So when you look at things on a scale of everything's got an electromagnetic component, and if you can manipulate it, that might make some sense with the white noise. They might have been trying to break through and make some sense of that white noise or the static
exactly.
that was going on.
Exactly. And that's what I feel. And you know, and I kept saying, hello, hello, hello. Nobody, I heard nothing, just this static sound. And then there was just, after a few minutes, of complete silence. So it was an awesome experience. Absolutely awesome. And I write about a guy that had contacted me for the book, who said his deceased brother tried to contact him on the phone one day. And his name was Nick. And Nick picked up the phone when the phone rang. And he actually heard his deceased brother say to him, Nick, it's okay. And he said, Tracy, I knew it was my brother because I know the sound of my brother's voice. So I knew it was him. So just three distinct words, Nick, it's okay. He says, and I quickly tried to dial the number, that you know, the callback number, to see where the call had come from. But got nothing, just dead.
Just flat, yeah. Flat. I've heard some cases too where they've tried that and it's just gone to nothing. Like, or it's gone to the phone company and it says, this, you know, check the number and dial again and things like that.
Right.
So there's so much you can learn from the paranormal. But with that said, how did you get into the book Alien Encounters in the Western United States? How did that book come about?
Well, to be honest with you, Peter, I've always wanted to write something about the subject. Since I'd had my own experiences, you know, back in 1987 up to present day. And because Schiffer had originally contacted me to write about the, you know, the Welcome to Haunted Las Vegas book, I approached them, you know, okay, I have an idea for this. And so we came up with Alien Encounters in the Western United States, because that's where I live in the Western United States. So I wanted to put something together that would educate people, as well as the other phenomenal books that are out there that, you know, researchers and writers are putting together, to educate people of what is really going on. So there are 9 true accounts in this book, Alien Encounters in the Western United States, some of which I personally investigated, and some which my very dear friend Dr. Roger Lear, who sadly passed away last year, wrote a chapter in here for me about alien implants and his whole thoughts on that, and what originally he thought it was and what it turned out to be, which is suspected alien implants. So I wanted to educate people is the short answer of it. I wanted to put something together that would show people that it's going on. It really is going on. And here are 9 true accounts to validate it.
What's one or two of the accounts in there that you could just give us a brief overview of?
One in particular was a guy who is a scientist. So very intelligent guy, very knowledgeable, very intelligent. Goes by the name, well, a totally different name in here, actually. We call him, what do we call him in here? John's Encounter. And John lives in California. And John had had experiences right from a kid. In fact, told me that he was a twin. But at around about 5 months into the pregnancy, his mother, who had gone to the doctor to have a checkup and make sure everything was okay with the pregnancy, the doctor had discovered that there were indeed 2 heartbeats within the mother's womb. And so a few weeks leading to a month go down the road, and goes back for a checkup, and only 1 heartbeat is heard. And the doctor doesn't know how to validate this. You know, he said, I distinctly heard 2 heartbeats previous months. So we know you were carrying 2 children, 2 babies in there. But, and this was something that John's mother shared with him, obviously, as he got older and as he was a man. Which led him to believe that, yes, my own mother was having extraterrestrial encounters. She was going through things, and indeed the child, the fetus, the baby, was taken. So it all started from a very, very young age. And then he experienced things as a 4-year-old, seeing the UFO hovering above the house, and bright lights coming from the UFO. And so it followed him all the way through his life. And up to the point where he married, and his wife was actually only a week pregnant when they decide they're going to go on a trip to Arizona, to the Grand Canyon. And they go out to Arizona on the trip and stay at a local hotel. And I think it was another part in Arizona that they were going to stay at the time. But his wife said, I want to go out to the Grand Canyon while we're here. I want to go see the Grand Canyon. So, but this was like 9 o'clock at night. And she just got this thing in her head that she wanted to go and see the Grand Canyon. So he said, Tracy, I was really reluctant to do it because of the time of the night. My wife was pregnant, didn't really want to go, but I couldn't shake her. I couldn't stop her from wanting to do it. So decided to do it, and we're driving along. And as we get closer to a specific road close to the Grand Canyon, she gets this really strange feeling. And so does he. And he says, we need to turn back. We shouldn't go any further. We need to turn back. So she said, okay, yeah, I think that's a good idea. So they turned around and they went back to the hotel. So they think. But what had actually happened was, after a few days of remembering this, they actually come to the part in the road just before they say, we need to turn back. A craft comes down and hovers over the road. The beings inside tell John that he needs to pull over in the vehicle. And he said, at that point, Tracy, what happened was my wife slipped through the seatbelt and went up through the roof of the car, up into the beam of light, up into the craft. And they told me to wait there by the side of the road for 10 to 15 minutes. He said, and at this point, as it started to approach 15 minutes, I'm getting very anxious and very afraid that she's not going to come back. He said, but she did. They brought her back, and they brought her back into the vehicle the way she had left. And that's through the roof of the vehicle, slipped her through the seatbelt and back into the passenger seat. At that point, they know nothing other than they get this weird feeling that I explained and said, we need to turn back. We have this really weird feeling and we need to turn back. So they just think they go back to the hotel and that's it. But they remember this incident a few days later. A few weeks ahead, skipping forward, John is abducted. John is re-abducted by these beings. And he said, Tracy, I told them when I was on board, please leave my wife out of this. I don't want her being involved. I don't want her taken. If you need to do anything, you need to do it with me. Leave my wife out of it. And they replied to him, well, as long as she doesn't have any more children, we will. They went on then to tell him what they had done with her and that they had given her a needle in the abdomen, in through the belly, very much like we have here, an amniocentesis. It was the same kind of thing. And John said, they obviously have an interest in his children. It was a boy, the first boy that was born, and he said he felt that they had done something with the genetics of this child. This child is very super smart, very super smart. A second boy came, and then the third child was a little girl. And John talks about how one particular day, his daughter, who was, I think, 4 years old at the time, said, Daddy, I'm afraid of the trash truck that comes. And he said, well, why are you afraid of the trash truck? She said, well, it reminds me of the spaceship that comes down with the little people and takes me up into the sky at night. So the whole family are encountering it. So, you know, he looks at the children's skin through the blue lights, through a blue light, infrared light to see when they're having encounters. He's finding different things like fingerprints, different colors, blues, oranges, yellows. He's finding on the children's skin, which indicates that these beings have indeed been around and, you know, been with the children. But he had an implant placed in his toe. It was the great toe of the left foot. Which and at the time...
Yeah, it's usually on the left side with the implants, isn't it?
It can be, yes, it can be. And it was with him, it was on the great toe. And he said, and at the time, living in Thousand Oaks, I didn't know of anyone. He said, I was very conscious of this being placed in my toe. I saw the apparatus that the beings used to put it in. So it was giving me a lot of pain, and I wanted to find a surgeon, a podiatrist that would have a look at it for me. Luck as had it that he lived in the same area as Dr. Roger Lear and found Dr. Roger Lear online. Called him up, made an appointment at his office, went along to see him and said nothing about his encounters, just that I'm having problems with my big toe of my left foot and I need you to have a look at it. So, of course, Dr. Lear, you know, took him through the x-rays, had a look what was going on and said, do you know you have a piece of metal in your toe? And John said, actually, yes, I do. And Dr. Lear said, oh, you do? He said, yes. He said, John said, I'm one of those people. Dr. Lear said, well, what do you mean by that? I'm one of those people. He said, I'm one of those people that get abducted. So Dr. Lear pursued it further and said, well, would you like me to, do you want to keep it in or do you want me to remove it? And John said, no, I would like to have it removed. So that's when they performed the surgery, and Dr. Roger Lear was telling me about this implant that was like a pencil lead, very thin, very small, and it broke in pieces as they were trying to remove it. They got 11 pieces out, and as they went back in to get the 12th piece, the 12th piece had completely gone. Which was odd, because there was a few surgeons in the room and they said they could see the 12th piece through the monitor and the whole equipment. They could see it. It's as if the beings had remotely taken that extra 12th piece back. And Dr. Roger Lear used to, after a removal of an implant, would put it in a small vial in the person's own body fluids. And refrigerate it, you know, for 24 to 48 hours. And Roger said the darnest thing happened. He said, when I went to check on this the very next morning, all the pieces started to reassemble themselves in the little vial in the client's home body fluids. So There's intelligence right there.
Yeah. Was it end up being tested at all, and how it was constructed or what it was made of?
Well, again, it was made of no known earthly isotopes.
Yeah, because when they look at the isotopic ratio of how it's constructed with whatever elements, it's not done on how it would be done here on Earth. It's usually like a meteorite how it's constructed. So
that is right. Yeah. And in fact, in the book, Roger talks about how these things are made of meteorites. First of all, how does a piece of meteorite get into someone's skin?
And it doesn't, like, usually if something's foreign to the body, it gets pushed out, encapsulated in pus, or it gets inflammation in the area, and that doesn't happen.
Right, there's no body rejection. The body does not reject it whatsoever. The body's own cells, interestingly enough, start to work its way around the implant so that the implant feels comfortable in its own surroundings. So made of meteorite, no known earthly isotopes, and highly magnetic. And in some of the implants he's removed, deep space radio waves.
Yeah.
I mean, deep space radio waves. And in Roger's estimation, he says, you know, we've had a look at these implants. We've analyzed them. We've had a look at them. And I've sent them to, you know, 5 or 6 laboratories, not only in the United States, but outside the United States as well, Canada, all over the place. And Roger said, we've come to the conclusion that these particular implants come from a civilization. They come from 1/3 across the Milky Way galaxy. They come from a civilization 30 million years older than we are. So, you know, how long has this whole thing been going on?
Did he go into depth how he came to that, like, why he believed that? In terms of how far and where these beings came from?
Purely through, I believe, looking at the fact that these implants were meteorites.
Yep.
They were made of meteorites. So they're looking at how old the element
is,
you see, of the actual implant.
Yep.
I was fortunate enough to be present when he did a surgery on an airline stewardess's arm and removed an implant. And funnily enough, this was on the right-hand side of the body and not the left. But it wasn't metallic like all the others that he removed. This one was biological.
Yeah, all right. That's the other type. Yeah.
Biological. It was in 2 halves with a black strip running right down the middle of it. And it looked like the only thing that we could describe it as, Peter, was like a clam.
God.
It was amazing. And as they went in to get this from her forearm, this thing shot up her arm like it had its own intelligence. It's like, no, 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 you're not going to get me. So they had to cut in further, lift it higher up as a tent almost, go very, very deep inside and grab this thing. And they got it. They pulled it out. And as all abductees say, once these things have been removed, they feel a whole new sense of freedom when these things are removed. It's almost as if, you know, they're watching what's going on within the DNA. And first of all, you know, Roger said he thought that these things were, in fact, tracking devices. But he said, I've come to believe, he said, that these things aren't tracking devices. They are monitoring your DNA. And if you've been taken, your mother's been taken, and your mother's mother's been taken, because what these beings are interested in, which you know, Peter, they're interested in lineage, bloodlines, family genetics.
That's interesting, because I'd never heard that about the, like, I've heard what you've said, but the DNA part of why these are implanted, because there is a tracking that is giving the radio waves a deep space, as you said, you know, these things, because before Roger pulled them out, he did a lot of scientific tests in readings and the electromagnetic field and the magnetometers and all these different things. So that was, you know, he did a really in-depth job in what he did, and it was, you know, recreated multiple times with a lot of people that had implants or reported implants in them. Did he say anything to you about these objects, anything about them recreating themselves, what he thought, how they were doing it? When he, you know, how that bit snapped off, and when he's put it in the body fluid of that person, he's gone back the next day and it started to reconstruct itself. Did he go any further into his thoughts on that?
He didn't, unfortunately. Just that this thing must have had its own intelligence to know that it needed to reassemble. And perhaps there was nanotechnology involved with all of this. But he said, you know, that 12th piece was definitely there because we all saw it. We all saw it. And then, of course, you know, turning away and doing what we were doing and putting, you know, the body fluids into the vial and putting the pieces or whatever the other doctors were doing, that must have been the point when this was remotely removed from the big toe.
Yeah, yeah. See, it's just fascinating doing this sort of thing because I've come across ones that had or heard of and come across people with reported ones that were monitoring DNA, but not that were physical. They were more energetic type implants. And these are something that anybody could touch or pick up, because this is what Roger dealt with, was the nuts and bolts of it, and came across a lot of commonalities. So that's interesting there. Instead of giving the whole book away, but is there any sort of thing else that's in it that just blew you away while doing this?
Yeah, I mean, lots of it. I mean, there is a story in there called Alice's Encounter. Alice, very briefly, because I don't want to ruin it for anyone if they go and get the book, and I hope they do. But Alice had gone to a UFO conference, and she had gone out. I'm just trying to remember where she had gone. She had gone out to a specific part of, that's right, the Coronado Island. She went to the Coronado Island in California. And was staying at a hotel there. And at the time, President Clinton and his wife Hillary were visiting the area. And the whole place was full of SAS people, Secret Service people, you know, full of Secret Service people. And he said, and she said, you couldn't go anywhere without seeing the Secret Service people all over the place because of the president, the ex-president being in town. And so they went to this UFO conference, and that's when it all happens. She goes with her friend. Actually, there's a few friends. There's about three friends that go, plus her brother and his wife. So there's about six of them that go. And that's when the story unfolds, that when they go to the Coronado Island, during the weekend of the conference, Greys come into the hotel. They take her brother's wife up through the ceiling. He has some kind of implant in his ear. They come through the window of the hotel to get Alice. Her friend sees all of this, knows that they're not coming for her, although she's had encounters. Yep. And she's had encounters with the praying mantis type beings. But they come for her, and they take Alice out of the window up into the craft. They obviously bring her back. And Yvonne Smith, who's well known as the hypnotic regression therapist, was hosting the conference at the time and took some of these people through regression therapy to remember what had happened. But they said there was just ETs all over the place in the hotels, the Del Coronado Hotel and another one down the road. I think it affected like 14 people on that particular one night at the weekend. But that's a very interesting case, purely because President Clinton was there. I mean, did President Clinton know what was going on?
Yeah, well, these are the questions, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, Secret Service were posing as waiters in the hotel, you know, with the white towel over the arm, talking into the cuffs of their sleeves. So they had a lot of different things going on. And also with a few cases where, you know, these women go on board and there is like an onboard incubatorium. They get to see onboard incubatoriums with rows and rows and rows of baskets, a very dim blue lit light behind the baskets. And one in particular, which is the first encounter in the book, is that her name is Dina. Her, you know, pseudonym name is Dina, and she's taken on board and at the age of 16 with other 16-year-old girls. And she says, we are then approached by this drone, which looks like a gray, but it's a drone. And it says to her, you need, and to the girls, you need to take every baby out of the basket and you need to breastfeed it. And she said, and I looked at it and I said, well, I can't do that. And I can't do that because this child isn't mine and I don't have breast milk. How can I do that? She said he just instructed her to just do it. Just do it. So she said she and all the other 16-year-olds, which was, I think there was another five or six girls, they took the babies out of the baskets and they proceeded to hold the babies in a way that they were holding them to the breast as if they were breastfeeding. And this, I don't know what it was, some drone, some robot or something, just watched what was going on as they were doing it. And as they were doing it, she says she noticed a reptilian type being standing to one side, wearing a cloak, and watching these girls go about doing this to make sure that they were complying. She said, that's the only thing I could think of why he was standing there, that he was watching that we would all comply. But he wore this cloak. Didn't interact, didn't say anything, just watched what was going on. So, and you know, in another case with another lady from Las Vegas, same kind of thing. Taken into an incubatorium. She's not met by a gray though, she's met by a tall lady that's bald. She's an ET, but she's totally bald. She proceeds to take Chris, which is her real name, through the craft, shows her the consoles of the craft. She says, I just see the vastness of space through the glass windows, and I think, oh my goodness, just look at that sight that I'm seeing out there. Takes her then out of that area of the ship into an incubatorium where she pulls a basket out, and she said there's a lifeless baby lying there in the basket, but this baby had really big blue eyes. Really big blue eyes. She says, and I just remembered looking at it and thinking, my, how big the eyes are of this baby. And she tells her telepathically, Chris, to take the baby again and hold the baby and show it loving emotion. Mm-hmm. And she says, and I'll never forget it, Tracy, because the little hand of the baby wrapped its hand around my little finger as I'm holding it. And I felt the baby hold on to my little finger. She says, and I just wanted to burst into tears, you know. But she says, I think the female being felt that. She felt my emotion. But wasn't instructed to do anything else other than hold this child. So this is kind of like a reoccurring theme. And I know Dr. David Jacobs has written about it in his books, Secret Life and The Threat. You know, and the late Bud Hopkins. I hate saying late to all of these people. Mm. The late Bud Hopkins, the late Dr. Roger Lear, you know, the late Dr. John Mack. All these fabulous people, researchers that we've had, you know, the graciousness of knowing that are no longer with us, that have been really great investigators on these cases and speak about the same kind of things over and over and over.
Yeah. Now, they've got a lot of sort of groundwork covered for a lot of researchers that are being introduced into this field to go back and research and get some understanding on some deeper things that have already been covered. So, you know, their work's been detrimental. You know, it's like Alan Hynek as well, and people like Dolores Cannon and Dr. Emoto. Yes. All these people have done so much work. It's just sad they're no longer with us, but they are in another way. With that said, but where's this all gone for you in terms of when you started out with this? Obviously, you thought about the interdimensional aspect, the alien from another place, you know, aspect and all that, but it always leads to a deeper theme, which is consciousness. How's this journey been for you in terms of going from that to the deeper understanding or trying to understand this paranormal reality, which is really normal?
That is a very good question, Peter, because indeed it is normal. Mm. I don't think there's anything paranormal about it. It is normal, and we live with this world around us that interacts with us. So it is very, very normal. For me personally, it's made me feel that I have a deeper role to play in all of this in some way, shape, or form. And I've actually had a couple of experiences as well, one of which I was conscious of. and one that I was not conscious of that I had regression for. And in that regression, we came to find out that when I was 5 years of age, I'm in a park in England, a children's park, with my grandparents at the time. My parents worked, and when we had holidays from school, my grandparents took care of my sister and I. And on this particular day, we went to the local park, and we took the dog. And we get to the park, and I am pulled away from my grandparents and my sister and the dog. And I don't know how I end up getting pulled away. I mean, I don't mean, you know, outside the park or anything like that. I'm in the park, and I'm a few hundred feet ahead or something, and yards, and this grey, tall grey being that I remembered seeing on board the craft, that was very, very old and had wrinkles. I'll never forget it as long as I live. He had folds, I should say, not wrinkles, folds on his cheeks, and they came way down here. And he turned to me, and I remember looking up at him. I was only five. I mean, he looked like a giant to me, but he was like a 5'5" tall gray being. And he said to me that when you are older, we are going to use you for something, but it's not yet. It's not yet, but it's of importance, but we are going to use you for something. And I remembered someone shouting my name, whether it was my grandmother or my granddad shouting my name. And I turned, and as I turned back to him, he'd gone. So that stayed with me since the regression, because I consciously didn't recall that at all. So that to me is part of, it plays a part in that deeper feeling, that deeper knowing to me, that there's a bigger role for me in this. And I don't know where it's going to lead me. I don't know. I just know that what I do and what I research belongs to the people. We need to have knowledge of it. We need to have some understanding of it in some way, if we can, and get to the bottom of the truth as to why they are here and who they are, what this is, who we are as human beings, why they're so interested in this planet. And I do believe that, you know, there's no other planet like this. I'm sure there's life elsewhere, but I think we have very unique life here. In fact, John in the book was told that by these beings, that there is life out there on other planets, but this is a unique form of life here that they're interested in coming to, you know, explore. So I await to see what my role is in all of this, Peter.
With the conscious recollection that you do have, are you able to go into any of that?
The recollection of that one, of the regression?
Oh, like of any experiences, like with the recollection, the conscious recollection, like, you know, knowingness of the experiences that you have had, besides the sightings, has there been anything else?
Well, let's see here. The one with the regression is way too long to go into, but it kind of happened when I went missing in Florida for about 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And my friend got to witness that. Maybe that's another show. But one of which I was conscious of was when I lived in England, and having moved back from London, he and I rented a house together, and he was into yoga and chanting and, you know, Indian cultures and things like that. And one particular morning, he used to get up very early to do yoga, 6 a.m. in the morning, and he'd gone downstairs to do his yoga. And I was sleeping up in the bedroom. And I was starting to wake up round about that same time, round about 6 o'clock. And what I saw at the foot of the bed, we have wardrobes, by the way, in England. In America, we don't have wardrobes where we keep our clothes. We have closets here, but in England, we have wardrobes. And I remember seeing the wardrobes, at the, you know, in the bedroom. And my bed, and then right at the foot of each corner of the bed, only about maybe 2.5 foot tall, 3 at the most, and probably that's a little bit too tall, were two beings. They weren't greys. They were in hooded cloaks. a little bit like monks' habits. They
Mm-hmm.
were in like a brownish tan Hessian sackcloth. But they stood there either side of the foot of my bed, and I saw no faces. It was completely black here, no faces. And I see this as I'm coming to. And I start to scream for my partner's name. I started to scream his name to the top of my lungs, and I know I'm shouting his name, but nothing's coming out. And I'm shouting with such force, but nothing is coming out. It is silent. This teeny hand from the right-hand side of my bed, and I'm thinking probably was a grey, and I have small hands, and people say to me, I don't know how you trained as a concert pianist because your hands are quite tiny. The hand of the being fitted right inside my hand. It was very tiny. And it cupped its hand and it pulled it back over my mouth and pulled my head back onto the pillow. And I just went back onto the pillow and I was out. And I don't remember what happened for the amount of time that I was out. But I can tell you that when I came to, it felt like it was only 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it, and I pulled my bed covers back. I ran out of the room. I ran down the stairs. I went to my partner, and I said, where were you? And there he is doing his yoga in a very peaceful environment. And I barged through the door and shouted, where were you? I was shouting your name. Where were you? He said, Tracy, what are you talking about? I heard nothing. I said, but I was shouting your name to the top of my lungs. He said, no, you weren't. I heard nothing. Then I, of course, went on to tell him what had just happened to me. It was about 8 o'clock when I came round. So roughly 2 hours had gone. And I don't know where I was in those 2 hours. I have no idea. But I know that happened to me because I was conscious for that one. Wasn't conscious for the other,
mm-hmm.
but I was conscious for this one.
That's fascinating. I've had similar experiences too, and then you just come to and it's just complete missing time. And what can you do about it, Sometimes you can get a regression, even sometimes then there's still a block or, it's sometimes just not, time to know what really happened. Sometimes we might not be able to handle what really happened, which is why there's that block as well.
That's right. And that's why I was just about to say to you, Peter, if people out there who are considering regression, I think it's a really great thing to do. And I think it can tap into the subconscious. I think it's a good tool if it's used in the right way. But for the person on the other end of it that is going to relive what had happened, you're going to live with that for the rest of your life. So just really think about it before you go ahead and do it, because you do have to live with it for the rest of your life. It hasn't affected me in a negative way. I feel that it's all been beneficial to me.
Yeah.
It's benevolent, and nothing malevolent whatsoever. But I think, just think before people go ahead and do it. Do I really want to explore? Do I really want to find out? Because once I know, and there's no going back.
Yeah, well, that's what I've said to people too, is there's the wanting to know, and you can be all airy-fairy about it, but when it comes to, your life will change because you're going to relive it and you're going to be able to decode what happened. That's a whole new matter, because you don't have the wondering anymore.
Right.
You've got some conclusion to what's happened, but it changes, it sets in concrete certain things.
Yes.
And like you said, you can't go back after that, can you?
You can't, Peter, no. And to be honest with you, I personally wouldn't change any of my sightings or experiences. I wouldn't. They've been a part of who I am today. And It's like they're saying to me and the world, wake up, people, wake up. With all the doom and gloom that's going on in the world, it still really is a really great place to be and a great place to live. And we've got to recognize this in some way and realize that there's meaning to why we're here.
Definitely, definitely. Well, that is a great note to wrap this up on. But before we finish this, would you like to point people in the direction where they can go to find out more about yourself and the work that you've done?
Absolutely. You can go to my website, letstalkparanormal.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the clips of the shows on there. I have both of my books on there as well. And my bio's on there. You can read a little bit more about me and who I am and what I do. And, you know, if you've got experiences, write me an email. Let me know. And maybe there's another book that we can include you in.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Tracy, thank you so much. I'd love to have you back on, so I'll stay in contact with you. And
please,
I appreciate
do.
You taking the time to do this.
Thank you. It's been an absolute honor and a pleasure. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.